Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. For years, physicists have thought they were close to solving the mysteries of the universe. Close, but no cigar. No way to fit the atoms of quantum mechanics into the galaxies of the general theory of relativity. But now, the great Stephen Hawking and his colleague, Caltech physicist Leonard Mlodinow, say the big, big, big questions about how and why we are here and why there even is a here may be solved. And God, they say, is not part of the equation. This hour On Point, the grand design, time, the universe, everything. You can join the conversation. Has Stephen Hawking been your guide to the universe? Are you ready for the grand design? Does your head hurt when cosmologists say there are infinite universes? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Stephen Hawking, the Cambridge University physicist, famously deals with advanced Lou Gehrig's disease. He communicates laboriously with machine-generated speech. We'll hear him on his new book today on tape. Here he is, reading from his 1988 bestseller, A Brief History of Time, from Errol Morris's 1992 documentary of the same name.
If we do discover a complete theory of the universe, it should in time be understandable in broad principle by everyone, not just a few scientists. Then we shall all, philosophers, scientists, and just ordinary people, be able to take part in the discussion of why it is that we and the universe exist. If we find the answer to that, it would be the ultimate triumph of human reason. For then we would know the mind of God.
Then we would know the mind of God. Stephen Hawking from his 1988 bestseller, A Brief History of Time. The latest word in the grand design, God not necessary to the origin of all. Joining me now from Pasadena, California is Leonard Mlodinow. He is a physicist at the California Institute of Technology, author of The Drunkard's Walk, Euclid's Window, Feynman's Rainbow. He collaborated with world-renowned Cambridge University physicist Stephen Hawking in the 2005 book, A Briefer History of Time, and now they are out with a new book co-authored. It's titled The Grand Design. Leonard Mlodinow, thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you, Tom.
There's so much to get into, and it's just as big as it gets, but a lot of our listeners will wonder first how Stephen Hawking is doing. How did you work with him? When do you see him, and how's he doing these days?
Well, I first started working with Stephen, I think it was around 2002. My first book, Euclid's Window, had come out, and coincidentally, he was thinking of writing the book that became A Briefer History of Time. Mm-hmm. The idea for A Briefer History of Time was to be a simplification or a clearer version of A Brief History of Time, because Stephen recognized that a lot of people didn't understand the original. And so he was looking for an author to write it with at the time, and he had trouble finding anybody that he found satisfactory. And when he read Euclid's Window, he liked the way I wrote, and he liked the fact that I was a physicist. So one day I just got a call, and my agent who had handled that book said, how would you like to write another book with Stephen Hawking? I said, sure, that sounds like fun.
Absolutely.
I didn't think about that very long.
No.
So after we did that, that was, of course, about the ideas in the original book, which was written, came out in the late 80s, but mm-hmm. was written through the 80s. I think he told me it took him 6 years to write that one.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we had fun writing A Briefer History of Time, and I thought it would be great to write a book on his latest ideas. And right around that time, he was developing some really interesting and exciting new ideas in cosmology. And as well, there was great new data and observations coming out of WMAP. And I thought, you know, this would be a great book. So he comes to Caltech every year for about 6 weeks to visit. Mm-hmm. And so I popped into his office one day, and I just said, hey, Stephen, how would you like to write another book on your latest thinking? And he just said, sure. And that was it. No great debate, no back and forth too long. And a short 4 years later, we have the book.
And from there, the grand design. Tell us exactly how Stephen Hawking communicates, because you're into communicating maybe the biggest ideas in the universe here. How does he do it exactly now, Leonard?
Well, at first he would use his thumb, so a lot of listeners might remember that he used his thumb. But
his
now
thumb to do what?
Well, I'll tell you in a minute. Mm-hmm. But to basically get the bits out. But right now he has a little sensor on the right on his glasses on the right side that detects when he twitches his cheek, and what that does, whether it was the thumb or the sensor, is it detects a mouse. It's like a mouse click. So with the thumb, he would be literally clicking a mouse, and with his cheek, it gets sent via a wireless connection to his wheelchair computer, and it's like a mouse click. And then on his computer screen, he has two methods for communicating. One is an old DOS-based system, and one is a Windows-based system. And I don't think your listeners want to hear the details, but basically it's like playing a video game. He chooses the letter that he wants. In one system, he chooses the first letter, let's say. And there's a cursor that's bopping around, so he has to click when it's on the right letter or group of letters, and then he narrows it down. Then when he has a letter, it gives him some words that it guesses he wants, and then if it's, he either clicks on one of those words or he puts the second letter in, and then it gives him words with those first two letters, so and
letter
so
by
on.
Letter, word by word. Is he using a twitching cheek now, Leonard, because his thumb isn't working anymore?
Yes. What happened was his speed of communication gradually deteriorated, and then they got this new system with his cheek. And, you know, he's being tested all the time for the new. There's the EEG systems. There's eye tracking systems. So I think he'll eventually upgrade to a different technology. It's just a matter of getting it, you know, waiting for the new technology to be properly developed and then getting it right.
But Stephen Hawking's mind still fully in gear, as we can see here in the new book, The Grand Design, you've got with him. We managed to get hold of tape where he's talking about this book, and it's very recent tape from a question put to him by a German TV interviewer last month. One of the things that comes up in this book is, the beginning, who created what. Can laws of nature replace God? That's the kind of question that it was put to Stephen Hawking right here from your very latest work. Let's listen to his computer-generated voice response to maybe some of the biggest questions of all.
Science can explain the universe without the need for a creator. God is the name people give to what they don't understand. But science explains the universe in a way that we can all comprehend.
A very few words and a very big idea got a lot of the world's attention just last week, or in this country anyway, Leonard, when that came out. God not necessary to creation of cosmos was the headline. It's essentially what you're saying. Begin to take us into the science here. What do we know now that we might not have known once that can lead you and Stephen Hawking to make a statement like that?
Well, the book is about two fundamental questions. One is, where did the universe come from? And the other is, why are the laws of nature what they are? And people have been asking those questions for centuries and come up with different answers. But in what we're writing about in The Grand Design is Stephen's latest thinking, which has been developed over 40 years, but a lot of the new ideas have come just in the last 10 years. And the ingredients in this are really three things, which I can get into in more detail if you like. One is called the No Boundary Proposal. That was talked about in his original book, The Brief History of Time, and that has to do with the nature of time in the very early universe. The second is a new idea that he's been writing about the last few years in physics papers, which is called top-down cosmology. And top-down cosmology is a new way of making predictions, of looking at how you make predictions in cosmology. And the third are the latest developments in M-theory, which is a theory of the fundamental forces of nature that's been developed over the last 10-15 years. So we put those three together, and on a fundamental level, of course, it all comes from quantum theory and general relativity. And the conclusion is that this and many other universes, all with different laws, were created spontaneously out of nothing.
Well, that of course, raises a big question. How does that happen? The question here's that question put to Stephen Hawking. You know, why does something exist and not just nothing? How can something be created out of nothing?
It is because gravity and quantum theory cause universes to be spontaneously created out of nothing.
Gravity and quantum theory causing universes, plural, to be spontaneously created out of nothing. Now, I know, Leonard, there's a universe of thought behind that, but begin to take us into it. I mean, that's when people say that there must be God, it's often because, you know, where did things come from? Something had to make the first thing, And you and he, Stephen Hawking, are saying right here, no. How?
Well, people over the ages have thought that one reason that you need God is to make the universe. And another reason that people have thought is that to make the laws of nature and our environment as habitable as it seems to be for human life and for life in general. Even Isaac Newton, who was a very rational physicist, thought that God had to intervene sometimes to reset the orbits of the planets, because otherwise they would eventually, due to the perturbation of the different planets, all the planets would crash into the sun or go flying away. Mm-hmm. And people have thought that in order to have water, you need to have God to design it. I've even read someone saying that horses were designed for people to ride them. So people have had these different thoughts all through the ages. And we're not saying in our book that there is no God. I want to make that clear to your listeners. And we're not saying don't believe in God. We're not saying we prove that there's no God. We're just saying that the theories we describe in our book answer these questions from the point of view of modern science, and God is not necessary for the answer.
In other words, the answer or answers to the ultimate questions. Where do we come from? How does something come from nothing? Science can explain all that. That's just about as big as questions get, I suppose.
Well, we think so. And anyone who's a physicist or who's interested in science, or I think more broadly, people who just look around and look at the world, I think it's a natural question to ask, why is it like this and how did we get here?
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about the shape and origin of everything, as described by physicists Stephen Hawking and Leonard Mlodinow in their new book, The Grand Design. God, they say, is not necessary to explain the cosmos. Science will do it. Leonard Mlodinow joins us from the radio studios at Caltech in Pasadena, California. Here's a little bit more from Stephen Hawking. This is 2006. Hawking visited Israel and the Palestinian territories. During that trip, he gave an interview to Israeli TV. After asking Hawking some questions about God and science, the interviewer asked him point blank, do you believe in God? Here's Hawking's answer.
The laws of science determine the evolution of the universe. These laws may or may not have been decreed by God, but he cannot intervene to break the laws, or they would not be laws. That leaves God with the freedom to choose the initial state of the universe, but even here, it seems there may be laws. So God would have no freedom at all.
Laws of the universe bigger than God, however you may define that. Leonard Mlodinow, take us right back to this question then. How then something comes from nothing? Take us into the physics. Help us understand.
Well, the key to this is quantum theory. And in quantum theory, the properties of nothing are very interesting because it says that there will always be fluctuations of something, even when you have nothing, and really that there is no nothing. And when you add gravity to that, gravity allows the matter to be created, of course, which costs energy, but gravity allows negative potential energy when the matter is created. So it allows you to maintain the energy balance in the universe of nothing, of zero, and to create matter, in a sense, for free. When you put all this together, it's a little bit more complicated than that, but when you put it all together, the nothingness can fluctuate into many universes. And that's essentially where the universe and other universes came from.
But you're saying that maybe or indeed there never was nothing, there was always something? That gets into the issue of time.
No, I'm not saying that there never was nothing, but mm-hmm. that the nature of nothing in quantum mechanics is not mm-hmm. exactly the nature of nothing that we have in our idea of everyday life, that nothing can spontaneously turn into something, and that's what happened.
Here's Stephen Hawking. This is in 2008, delivering a speech with his computer-generated voice to the TED Conference, 08 in Monterey, California, up the coast from you there. His theme here was asking the big questions about the universe and boldly going, we're only, I don't know, physicists and men of philosophy and faith have gone before, suggesting here that the mystery of creation has been solved.
Under extreme conditions, general relativity and quantum theory allow time to behave like another dimension of space. This removes the distinction between time and space,
and means the laws of evolution, can also determine the initial state. The universe can spontaneously create itself out of nothing. We think we have solved the mystery of creation. Maybe we should patent the universe and charge everyone royalties for their existence.
Stephen Hawking there. Leonard Mlodinow, unpack this for us.
Okay, well, the first thing he was talking about was what he calls the no-boundary proposal, or the no-boundary condition, when he said that time begins to behave like space. So the way that works is, you know, in our universe today where we live, we have a certain intuitive feeling of time. Of course, we talk in the grand design about how all our, even our personal theories of how the world works are based on our senses and our own way of thinking. And, you know, and that we do have a certain feeling for what time means. And we've learned through physics that as we go backwards in time, the universe was smaller. And the further you go back, the smaller, the denser it was. Eventually you get back to a certain point where the universe was dense enough and had enough matter in it that when you combine quantum theory and Einstein's theory of general relativity, the nature of time starts to change. You know, Einstein, as opposed to Newton, said that time and space are not fixed. Newton saw time and space as a fixed stage upon which plays may be enacted, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. And they were separate, and the players didn't bend the stage, and the stage didn't affect the players. But mm-hmm. but in Einstein's theory, they do interact, and what happens in the universe with matter and energy affects space and time, and space and time affects matter and energy, and it's all interconnected. Now, in our everyday life, we don't really notice that except in GPS systems, it has to be taken into account. But in most of what we do in everyday life, we don't have to take that into account. And we certainly don't sense it with our force, with our senses.
Hawking's saying here that the distinction between time and space is removed. What does that mean exactly?
Well, it means that mathematically, space begins to act like another dimension of time, so that your ideas that you have of time, and when you're saying what happens at the beginning of time, they don't apply when you go back far enough in time. And one good analogy is this, that many years ago, people thought that the world was flat, and mm-hmm. they thought that space, this is two-dimensional, let's say the surface of the Earth was flat, and they wondered what happened if you went in some direction. You would get to the beginning or the end of the Earth, you'd get to the edge, and do you fall off, or is there something beyond it? If there's something beyond it, what does it mean to say it has an edge? And all these questions puzzled people. And obviously they learned that the Earth is round and it has no boundary. So Stephen says that time is like that as well. In early time, time behaves like that globe of space.
So you're saying no beginning, in a sense, then, and no end.
It makes no more sense to ask what's the beginning of time than what's north of the North Pole. So that's his first proposal, and that's what he was talking about there.
Then, at the same time, though, he's talking about, he says, the universe can spontaneously create itself out of nothing. Creation sort of suggests time, doesn't it?
Well, time and space and all the laws of nature were created together. So you can't trace the universe, the history of the universe back in time like you would on a railroad track. You go back, you find the station, you say, oh, here's the beginning of the railroad track. Here's what the station looks like. That you can't go back that far. But everything appeared from nothing along with all the laws and space and time, the whole framework appeared.
Okay, we're working hard to stay with you here. In that case, though, he's still talking about spontaneous creation. What we've learned in physics and science tell us about how that would have worked?
Well, the other new idea that he has, or that's in the book, is called the top-down cosmology, and that differs from traditional cosmology. Let me tell you how it mm-hmm. differs. Mm-hmm. First of all, it's a quantum approach to cosmology. And most cosmologists, in most of cosmology, we follow the universe as if it has one history, and you look at some state of the universe at early times, and then you trace its history forward with a single history, just as we're used to in everyday life, and we call that in physics, classical mechanics. In Newton's laws, if you have a billiard ball on a table and you set it rolling, it has a definite position and velocity at every time. And when you make a measurement, all you're doing is learning what the position is at that time. But it had that position anyway, and it has a whole definite history. Mm-hmm. In quantum theory, it makes no sense between your measurements to say that these properties that you're going to measure exist. They only exist when you measure them. And the billiard ball, the quantum billiard ball, does not have a single history or a single path along the billiard table. in a sense, has every possible path between your measurements. So Stephen says in the top-down cosmology that, as opposed to the usual cosmology, since the universe is quantum, we have to look at it that way. The second ingredient in top-down cosmology is what the name comes from. He says we should look at it from the top down. Now, in ordinary cosmology, people look at an initial condition of the universe. In ordinary physics, in fact, people look at an initial condition of their system in the laboratory. We prepare a system in a certain way, the experimentalists, and then let time run forward, and then they take measurements of that system at a final, at a later time. Mm-hmm. And then they compare what they measure to what the predictions were based on the initial state.
Okay.
But Stephen says, you know what? First of all, we're part of this experiment. We're not outside setting up a lab. We have no control or even knowledge of the initial conditions. And what can we really do? All we can do is make measurements today. So top-down cosmology is based on the idea that you should trace the history of the universe backward from the present time rather than forward from the past. So we're tracing it backward from the present, and we're acknowledging that there are many different histories. And so that all of that put together leads to this idea of multiple universes and the quantum creation of the universe.
Many different histories and multiple universes. I want to hold that one for just a second, but I know it's integral here. Let me just put another very simple, I don't know, dumb question. But I mean, in your metaphor there with the billiard ball, you still got a billiard ball. So why is there something rather than nothing at all? Why is there anything?
In terms of the billiard ball, you mean?
No,
the
I mean in the cosmos. I mean, at least
because
we perceive that there are planets and galaxies and quasars, and you know, why? Why not just nothing?
From nothing, according to the quantum laws, something will appear. That's the simple answer. You can't put a lid on it.
And that's mathematically proved?
Well, quantum theory is extremely well verified over many, many decades. It's probably our most tested theory in physics. The fluctuations, what we call vacuum fluctuations, are also extremely well verified over and over in many experiments, and it causes all sorts of effects that we measure. The mass of a proton, you know, is made of quarks, but if you add up the masses of the quarks within the proton, you don't get the mass of the proton, but there's quantum fluctuations that add to it. This is a standard part of quantum physics, are the vacuum fluctuations, and that's been extremely well tested.
My mind is dancing with so many questions, so are the listeners. Let me begin to bring them in. Nashville, Tennessee, James, you're on with Leonard Mlodinow.
Hi, guys. Thank you for the topic. Mm-hmm. My first comment was that I've often found it strange that with the nature of time that you watch certain programs, read certain books, it tells you how old the universe is. But my question is, with the nature of the three physical dimensions and time, and the way that spin particles work, it was very difficult to first wrap your mind around that topic in brief history of time. And I was wondering if you had any advice for non-doctorate students how to conceive these existence of how things change in multiple dimensions outside of the three, or if things exist outside of the three physical dimensions that we perceive.
Leonard.
Well, physicists often have to think, and so do mathematicians, in many dimensions, in dimensions other than three. And we can't any better than you can. So what we do is we form models that we use. For instance, when we'll talk about it's hard to imagine three-dimensional space being curved. So we go, you know what, it's good enough to think about two-dimensional space for these purposes, and then we'll try and generalize and look at the differences and the similarities. And so instead of thinking about three-dimensional curved space, we often think about a two-dimensional plane, and then we can imagine it being curved. And we use tricks like that to imagine it. And after a while, you get certain intuition about three-dimensional curved space from your many imaginings of two-dimensional space being curved. But one thing I have to say that for people who are doing that, and we do use some of those analogies in our book, there's an important difference you have to keep in mind. When you're thinking of a two-dimensional plane or a sheet of paper, and you're thinking of curving it into like a cylinder or a donut or a sphere and thinking about how you can curve it, you have to remember that if you're in that space, you're probably imagining it from a distance, looking down upon it. And that's fine to do when you're imagining it, but for the point of view of the people in that universe, they don't have that view, and that doesn't exist. You have to imagine what they would see from within that space itself. So if you're trying to imagine two-dimensional space curved as a torus or a donut, don't think of yourself looking down on a donut. Think of an ant on the surface of the donut, and there's no possibility in nature for the ant to look down on it to get above it at all. Or maybe I should say a bacteria rather than an ant. This thing has no legs. It's sliding along the surface. And you have to think about what it will perceive sliding along the surface, and don't make the mistake of adding information from looking down on it.
You've got this great anecdote in the book, the Grand Design, to illustrate the dangers of just going with our senses, what we immediately perceive when we're trying to understand these huge questions. You write a few years ago that the city council in Monza, Italy, barred pet owners from keeping goldfish in curved goldfish bowls. And the law's sponsor explained that they did it because they thought it was cruel to keep a fish in a bowl with curved sides, because gazing out, the fish would have a distorted view of reality. But that would be that goldfish's view of reality. You're suggesting that we also look out through the prism of our immediate experience, which may or may not tell us everything.
Well, you put that very well. And we do say in the book that we have to think of ourselves that way. We tend to think that we're we have the final view, that through our senses and through what we know is the final view of the universe. But we have to recognize it, just like the goldfish. I mean, again, this is the outside versus inside view. I said when you curve the paper into a globe or a torus, remember that you can't stand outside. And, you know, we're looking outside into the goldfish bowl and going, well, of course, that silly goldfish a smart goldfish would come up with laws and of how the heavens move, which means the stuff outside of the goldfish bowl, and they would be curved, and you'd go, well, that silly goldfish came up with those laws because it was tricked by the bending of the light as it comes into the bowl. But remember, for the goldfish universe, and that is the universe, and that is the law, and that's a perfectly fine law. And the same way, we can't get outside our universe, and we can't get outside our brains. So we have to realize that we are like the goldfish, both because of the universe of our own brains and the universe that we live within.
So there are laws of physics that we may not perceive from our immediate senses. Mathematics help us do it. But there's another great question. Why this particular set of laws that we as humans have begun to uncover and not some other? Why?
Well, that's a very interesting question, probably more involved than one might realize at first, because it turns out that the laws that we have are very finely tuned, are very finely tuned in a way that allows us to exist. And one of the revelations for me in doing the research for this book was I knew that this was true, but I didn't quite realize how finely tuned the laws are. For instance, the mass of the proton can only vary within, I think, 2 parts in 1,000 without destroying the possibility of us being here.
That's the kind of observation that some religious believers say, once again, got to be God. Otherwise, why would it be so fine-tuned for human existence?
I understand that, and in fact, that's modern. It's interesting that modern observations would make that so vivid, because in the past people said, "Well, a horse couldn't be created. You know, why would we have a horse if not for people to ride on?" But now we say, "Why have the mass of the proton be so finely tuned?" And many other aspects of the natural law is finely tuned. And I can understand why people would think that, and I think it's a natural question. As it turns out, our physics is answering that question, and the answer was not designed to add to the answers that we have were not designed to address that question, but they do answer that question.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the shape and origin of everything, as described by physicists Stephen Hawking and Leonard Mlodinow in their new book, The Grand Design. Never mind our universe. There's a lot of talk about many universes. Here's Stephen Hawking again, talking about those. He was asked where and when those other universes exist, whether they're around us, whether we would ever detect them.
Other possible universes would be entirely separate from our own universe, so when and where they are, relative to us, are not defined. There is no way they could be measured.
Stephen Hawking, just last month, as his new book, co-authored with Leonard Mlodinow, came out, The Grand Design. Leonard, other universes, how many and why? We're hearing about infinite universes. Where does this perception come from?
Well, that ties into what I was saying before the break. Our laws of nature seem to be very finely tuned, but what Stephen's theories say, and actually many other theories in modern cosmology, is that we are not, this is not the only universe, and because quantum theory requires that other universes exist, and all those other universes have different laws of nature. M-theory allows for about 10 to the 500th different laws of nature, and these universes would have all of those laws. So there's a whole spectrum of, there are universes with a whole spectrum of laws. Some universes don't last very long. They are formed and immediately recollapse. Some of them, as ours, go on, and some of them are less long enough for stars, just for one generation of stars. Some of them for several generations, which is necessary for life to exist. You need at least a second generation, because when the universe is first formed, all you have is hydrogen, helium, and a little lithium, maybe a little beryllium, which disappears quickly. But from those elements, you can't really form life. But inside stars, the heavier elements are made, so you need to have the first generation of stars, then that dies, explodes in a supernova, the elements are redispersed, it's recondensed, they recondense into a next generation star, and that's where we came from. We're all stardust, really. We're all the product from inside of stars.
You see, it comes from quantum mechanics and M theory. What's M theory? M theory?
Okay. Well, physicists, especially since Einstein, have wanted to have a unified theory of all physics. You might wonder why that is. In some sense, it's an aesthetic or philosophical belief, but it's also a practical desire because, for instance, if you could have a theory of gravity for every object. You could have a bottle of water, and you have a theory of gravity. What happens if I let go and drop it? What happens if I throw a ball? What happens if I have an apple fall? What happens for the planets? What's the theory of gravity for the planets? And obviously, that's not very useful. And, of course, the beauty of Newton's theory of gravity and of Einstein's is that it applies, you know, to the apple falling, and also explains how the planets orbit. So that's, in a sense, a unification. That's one theory instead of a million theories. And physics has four forces. We found there are four forces in nature. There's gravity, electromagnetism, and the strong and weak nuclear force. And the history of physics has, in a way, been a history of unification of those theories. Mm-hmm. First, electricity and magnetism were thought to be different. Maxwell united those in the 19th century with great profit, too, because it, for instance, explains light, which was not understood to be an electromagnetic phenomena before that. Mm. So that we gain a lot by that. In the last century, the electromagnetic theory and the weak interactions were united. And so physicists are always trying to find this unified theory, which is what Einstein really wanted to do but didn't do. And in the 80s, these theories became popular, called string theories. String theory is an attempt to find a unified theory of all four forces, including gravity. And gravity is the hardest one to include. Mm-hmm. But it had a little problem, which is that there seemed to be five different string theories, that all of them seem to be equally have equal validity, and that's a bit of an embarrassment.
Crazy. Yeah.
You have a unified theory of four forces, but
right.
There's five of them.
Mm-hmm.
You go, mm. And then there was another theory called supergravity, and the miracle that happened in the mid-90s was that it was realized that these were all aspects of the same theory. So supergravity and the string theories all seem to be special limiting cases of a deeper, more fundamental underlying theory, and that's what's called M-theory. Don't ask me what the M stands for, because nobody remembers. It's something that came into usage, and nobody remembers exactly what it was originally meant.
Well, one thing I guess it doesn't stand for, and it's funny because you just used the word, was miracle.
Right.
One of the things you say in the book is that there are no miracles. But you're speaking as a scientist there, not a philosopher.
Well, and of course, and I should stress that this whole book, we're speaking as scientists and not philosophers. That's why we're not saying there's no God. And we're not telling you, you know, how to interpret the world for yourself. So when we say there are no miracles, we're as physicists, there are no miracles that in the natural world. We've been observing the natural world for quite a long time. We have quite detailed theories of the world, and the theories always apply. There aren't any exceptions.
Not saying there's no God, but you sure cut down on the real estate that God would inhabit, at least, you know, the sort of functions that many people have ascribed to God. Creation pretty much came number one.
Right, and we've definitely pushed back the need for a God several layers, or through history it's been pushed back. We know that we don't need God to create the earthly environment because we see how many planets there are and that there are almost certainly other planets with a similar environment. Darwin's theory of evolution showed that you don't need God to design people, that people can evolve through that theory. We say now that we don't need God to create the universe or to make the laws what they are. However, I want to say that we're not saying that God didn't do all those things. We don't want to tell people what to believe, and we can't prove that God isn't behind all that.
Are you saying that just to keep people from, throwing a rock at you?
Please don't throw rocks at me. But
religion has stoned people.
As a scientist, we have to be precise, and we don't want to overstep our bounds of what our arguments are. So just as being intellectually honest, we would not say those things. And so some people are misquoting us and saying that we said those things, and that's wrong.
Let's go to Roger in Atlanta, Georgia. Roger, you're on the air.
Hi, this is all, of course, very difficult for those of us who are not physicists to understand, so I'll just ask my question and hang up.
Yeah.
It seems like this theory is trying to apply quantum theory to time. So what does that do to the projected age of the universe? I'll hang up now.
Thank you, Roger. If there's no beginning and no end, or what about?
Well, the age of the universe, really what we're talking about is the age of the universe after the first 10 to the minus 34 or 10 to the minus 32 seconds. Earlier than that, time really has no meaning as we know it today. But if you start, let's say, from the first second onward, it's you can talk about time in more or less the way we talk about it. So we only know the age of the universe, it's 13.7, 3 billion years to about, I think, 4 decimal places. And so if we were going to specify the age of the universe to try to specify it to 40 decimal places, then that would be in conflict with what we know about time not existing back then. But to the level that we are observing there's no contradiction. And that. Thank you. That was a very good question. I imagine a lot of people are wondering that.
You're saying in that first second, there was something that eludes time itself?
Well, as I said earlier, mm-hmm. when the universe was squashed down to a certain extent because of quantum theory, interaction of quantum theory and general relativity, it really doesn't make sense to talk about time as we know it today, as we think of it today. And so it wouldn't make sense to say the age of the universe is X, starting from some time zero, but starting from some time 10 to the minus 32 seconds, we know it's existed that long, minus 10 to the minus 32 seconds, and before that, it doesn't make sense to talk about the question.
We're trying. Sanjeev in Boston, you're on the air with Leonard Mlodinow now.
Yeah, hi, I'm a long time listener, first time caller.
Thanks,
appreciate that, everything that you guys do.
Thank you.
Just had a question with regards to, I know you're talking about spontaneous creation. I was just wondering, your theory or, your intelligence behind the difference between the way the human brain is structured or the way humans are constructed as opposed to other mammals that are on the earth or even in other, the possibility of it being in other universes. How could you use your theories from, what Stephen Hawking is saying and kind of apply that to the complexity and the intelligence that's been developed from humans versus other mammals that's on the earth.
Thanks, well, Sanjeev. Leonard.
That's a good question, and unfortunately, I'd have to suggest, Tom, that you get an evolutionary biologist on to address that. Physics doesn't really address those issues of how humans and other mammals differ and how they evolved, and I hate to talk about things I know little about.
But it does intersect maybe in this way. I mean, because the physical laws that surround that evolution you are looking at, you write in the book, you say the multiverse, that is this almost infinite number of universes, the multiverse concept can explain the fine-tuning of physical law without the need for a benevolent creator who made the universe for our benefit. How does the fact of multiple universes come into what appears to be the fine-tuning of law that makes our existence possible?
Oh, yeah, let me clarify that. So what we're saying is that many, many universes exist with all sorts of different laws. In some of those universes, we'll not have this what we call fine-tuning. They will not have laws that are similar to the laws that we have in this universe. And in those universes, beings would not exist. In some of those universes, stars would not exist.
However, there are many universes, but in this one it happens. It's set up for what we are to have emerged.
I didn't say it was set up for us.
Oh, okay.
I'm saying...
It has...
Okay, well, let me say what I want to say.
Qualities, please.
Okay, I'll say it. Let me say it precisely. Okay, there are many universes with different laws. Among those are some universes, and it's the minority, that will have laws that would allow complex beings such as us to exist.
Mm-hmm.
Now, given that we exist and we're studying those laws, I think it's pretty obvious that we must be in one of those universes that would have allowed us to exist. In the other universes, there are no physicists thinking about these issues. So it's not a surprise that the laws are such that we can exist and they're so finely tuned, because it's only in those universes that we will discover those laws.
How do you know that in the other universes there are no physicists or some version thereof thinking of this?
Well, we don't know that, but as you know, we think, as we talk about in the book, mm-hmm. we talk about all the different things that seem to be necessary for intelligent life to exist. It's hard to imagine intelligent life if you can't have stars. So suppose that you just have a plasma of elementary particles, and eventually it cools down and it forms protons, and you know, have protons and electrons. Maybe it forms elements as it did in our mm-hmm. early universe, and all you have is, say, hydrogen, helium, and lithium.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to think that a intelligent beings could be created from those, then, I mean, I guess I was going to say I can't prove that they can't, but actually I think if you talk to a chemist, they can prove that you cannot make very complex molecules from that
Are you suggesting with that, Leonard, that it's only our universe that kind of looks like our universe, that has, you know, sort of stars?
No, there are many universes that look like our universe, and there are many more that don't.
But if the others have stars, then they've got the building blocks?
No. Okay, well, here's the steps that it takes. So mm-hmm. first, you have to have the primordial elements formed,
mm-hmm.
and then they need to condense. You need to have inhomogeneities in the early universe, which are areas of the early universe that are denser than other areas. And what that will do is attract matter toward them. And that if those eventually become stars and galaxies. Then those stars, because of the attraction of gravity crushing the matter ever closer together, will heat up and will form nuclear furnaces that take those primordial elements, and from them they create the heavier elements. Okay, so you need a universe with laws that will allow that. That's the first step. The second step is that when the star reaches the end of its life, it's going to need to explode to redistribute those heavier elements. And it can't just explode in any way. If a star in empty space just explodes, for instance, those elements are never going to recondense into a solar system. We know now that the environment, the galactic environment, is very important in order that after the star explodes, this process happens again and forms a second star. So you need to have all the laws be right just for that. Then you need the laws to be right for the second star to form and for beings such as carbon-based beings, or if mm-hmm. you can imagine silicon, you know, to be created. So there are a series of steps that have to happen, and we talk in some detail in the book about what those steps are, and they each imply various requirements on the physical laws that need to be true in order to allow those steps to happen.
And from all that,
here we are.
Here we are. Pam in Medford, Massachusetts.
Well,
Pam,
that's the miracle.
Yeah. Pam,
Hi.
You're on. Hi.
I'm a senior at Tufts, and I'm majoring in religion, and don't believe in God as we commonly believe in it, as, you know, that father figure, but a beautiful spirit throughout everything. And my big question that I'm always wondering is, how do we know that the universe came from nothing to begin with?
Well, the way we test our theories in physics is they're not just opinions. A theory is not a theory if it has no predictable consequences. And the biggest tool for cosmologists these days are the observations of what's called the cosmic microwave background radiation. Now, that's the afterglow of the Big Bang. That's kind of the heat left over from the Big Bang. And as it turns out, the specific fine structure and properties of that radiation tells us a lot about the early universe. And so we've been sending up satellites, first COBE and then WMAP, which is still out there, and now the new Planck satellite, to study those in the latest high-tech way and to learn the property of the microwave background radiation, but from those properties to distinguish between these theories. So that's how we that's how we hope to distinguish between these theories eventually.
Leonard, you and Stephen Hawking write in the book, you put the questions, what's the nature of reality? Where did it all come from? Did the universe need a creator? And then you say, traditionally, these are questions for philosophy. But you write, philosophy is dead. Hmm. Philosophy has not kept up with modern developments in science, particularly physics. Scientists have become the bearers of the torch of discovery. And you've done heroic work here in putting that in popular terms. But philosophy exists in even more popular terms. You know, can science ever really sort of own the popular understanding of these giant questions that you raise? Or will philosophy / religion always outflank you?
Well, the context of that was that philosophy as a means of investigating and discovering the nature of the physical universe is no longer useful. Before science was invented, before the scientific method, and before we were using mathematics to phrase our theories and experiments to test them and developing these very powerful methods of thinking about the universe that have led to modern society, people used to use their pure brain power and they would reason about the universe and they made certain progress. But what we're saying is that today, using science, we can make better progress. We can test it and see that whether or not it's what we're talking about makes sense by experimental verification. But people still, of course, should and are free to read into these interpretations anything that they want and to have their own faith and observe and interpret the universe as they will.
You're very generous with that, though you don't describe the laws of the universe as you find them being quite so generous. They are what they are, you say. Wow.
They are what they are, but you're talking about how people think about them.
Yeah.
Think about them as you like, but these are what the laws are, is what we're trying to say.
Leonard Mlodinow, co-author with Stephen Hawking of The Grand Design. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Our brains got to work out. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.